This is Spectator Radio. If you'd like to subscribe to The Spectator, you can get 12 issues for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Just go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Welcome to this, the fifth in our series of podcasts for this year's Spectator Economic Disruptor Awards. Today we're in Edinburgh, we're in the Register Club inside the Edinburgh Grand Hotel. We've had the rather extraordinary experience of lunching in a room that was once the office of the Chief Executive of the Royal Bank of Scotland. And who was that? It was, of course, Fred Goodwin, one of the great villains of the financial crisis of a decade ago. But here we are talking to entrepreneurs, talking to the next generation of exciting disruptor businesses. So if ever there was a vivid example of the cycle of capitalism turning, as it were, it's our lunch here in Edinburgh today, where we're meeting four finalists for the Scotland and Northern Ireland region. And with me, I have two of our judges. I have Irene McAleese, who is a founder of one of last year's winners. That's SeaSense, a business based in Newton Ards in Northern Ireland, based on technology of smart bicycle lights and of gathering data through bicycle lights to inform cyclists and city authorities and so on of the state of the roads, of state of traffic, state of potholes, and so on. So a kind of big data business based on bicycle lights. And it's a pleasure to welcome Irene back as a judge this year. Also with us is Gordon Scott, who is a regional director of Julius Baer, who are, of course, our sponsors for the Economic Disruptor Awards. So welcome back also, Gordon, who was with us in Manchester a few days ago. On the phone with us, we have our second outside guest judge, also coming back for a second year. He's Ian Ritchie. He's a veteran Scottish venture capitalist. He's chairman of a number of tech companies here in Scotland and has been involved over the years in something like 40 startup and early stage companies. So it's a pleasure to have his views as well in this podcast. We have four companies. So the first one we're going to talk about is called Delta DNA. Our guest at lunch was its chairman, Tim Christian, who is a veteran of the games industry and investor in a number of companies, and he came to talk to us about Delta DNA, which is a business that is using the data from live games playing largely through mobile phones, gathering the patterns of events in games playing, in millions of games players, 3 billion events, that is, choices being made by games players every day, 50,000 per second, and working out from that how Delta DNA's clients, who are the games companies, can maximize their revenues, can increase the spend of their customers, and so on, and making use of the data to enhance the games industry in a broader sense. He explained to us, in a way, it's a force for good. They can identify sort of troubled games players. They're not particularly involved with gambling companies. Gaming is a huge area of activity, and this is a way in which it's being more focused, better driven by the people who do the games tech. Irene, what was your observation of this one?
I guess what stood out to me was, I mean, in one sense, the sheer volume of data that they're processing in real time. So as you mentioned, you know, 200 million players, that's a lot of data to handle. So it's impressive. And he also mentioned that, you know, within a few days, they can kind of profile an individual gamer and start to get predictive and actually start to quantify what the lifetime value of that customer might be. So I can see the appeal of being able to sort of, you know, from a monetization point of view for the game developers to understand who their customers are, how to better enhance the experience and also tailor things to them. I think he said that they have now the population size, the size of Nigeria, is the number of people that are actually being monitored while they're playing the games. So that's impressive in terms of the amount of data.
Gordon?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's no news to all of us, the availability of data, but the ability, even on an anonymized basis, for Delta DNA to process those 3 billion pieces of data on a real-time basis and be able to provide back to developers news that their players are struggling at a certain level. Perhaps they need extra coins, or they need a hint, or they need to actually change the difficulty, or that they're about to stop playing because it's become boring, or they're drifting away from it, or their aptitude to respond to ads. Their business started off with the vision of small percentage numbers, but if they could move from 2% of players spending on in-app purchases to 3%, then they would have a viable business. As Irene's just said, the population of Nigeria have now been engaged, monitored, and are being encouraged to spend through that process. So big market, big business, and a clear market into the big developers and programmers, particularly for those phone-based games.
And Ian Ritchie, welcome to the podcast. So you have watched, I'm sure, the development of the online gaming industry as quite a major development in Scotland. We think of Dundee for video games and so on. But anyway, it's been a big thing in Scotland these past few years. Do you think this has competitors, or is this doing something that's really distinctive?
The games industry is indeed booming in Scotland. Two of the world's top 10 games are actually made here. Grand Theft Auto, which you'll have heard of, but also Minecraft and console editions of Minecraft are made in Scotland. So we've got two of the biggest players in the world. But that's the games industry. That's the people who make the games that they sell to consumers. Delta DNA is a backroom company. It supplies the games industry with intelligence as to how the games are being played, what bits and people are having difficulty with, which pieces are working well, how to encourage people to buy accessories or extras or all that type of stuff. So they're very much, as I say, a supporter of the games industry rather than being in the games industry themselves directly.
Thank you very much, Ian. So that's Delta DNA. We can see that is certainly sharpening up the performance of the online games industry. And we learned also that there's an element of social responsibility to it. We shouldn't be puritanical, as I perhaps am tempted to be, about gaming as an activity. It's a huge activity, particularly for younger people around the world now. And this is a business that's kind of sharpening its focus, making it more efficient. So that's Delta DNA. Our second candidate at the table was in the arena of television advertising. It's TV Squared. We heard from its chief executive, Callum Smeaton. And again, this is a data analysis business. This is a business that is in real time monitoring the responses online to television viewers who are seeing advertisements, whether they're actually seeing them in real time or even on sort of playback mechanisms and so on, whenever audiences see adverts and reach for their other devices and go on to the website, or they make a purchase, or they do something else that's measurable on their devices. TV Squared is keeping track of that and feeding it back to advertisers so that they can much more efficiently target where their advertising is going. A fascinating example was an American clothing brand new to all of us called Untuck It, which is basically wearing your shirt untucked, as I understand it. Is that correct? Yes, my colleagues are all nodding to me. And the discovery that by putting the ads into children's television segments when mothers are watching but with their iPad or their phone in their hand, and that women are then buying these shirts for their menfolk, rather than the menfolk seeing the ads at a different time of day and buying them themselves. Anyway, we get the idea that the pattern of actual responses to TV advertising isn't necessarily what the advertisers predict for themselves without seeing this data. So it's making TV advertising perform much more efficiently. It's explaining what works and what doesn't from real data analysis. And it struck us as a very clever business. So, Gordon, what did you think?
Yeah, absolutely. Fighting back against the kind of commonly held view that TV advertising was all but dead as we kind of operate in a world of on-demand streaming. So this, Cal was able to bring to us a number of live examples alongside the one that you've just mentioned, Martin, where their data analytics, again on an anonymized basis, has really helped provide their customer base, those advertisers, real insight as to what's working, who's buying, why are they buying, and the methodology to get to their website. So it's really streamlining front to back and helping people make sensible, sound advertising decisions.
We heard that although TV is in some ways a declining medium, it's still a $200 billion market and still everything to play for in getting it right, as it were. Let's hear from Ian Ritchie on this one.
Yeah, well, TV Squared, I'm aware of when the company started. It was actually a friend of mine was doing some online retailing and did some TV, but he was very frustrated by the fact that he didn't have any idea whether a TV ad was working or which one was working, which one wasn't, and so forth. And so Callum developed this solution, which is to monitor really people accessing or following up on calls to action from TV adverts. So a TV advert gives you a web address, you know, contact us for more details or whatever. And what TV Squared has done is it's actually tied the responses to these adverts to when the advert is playing. So you know that an advert is working well on X channel, another channel perhaps it's not working as well on. Now that's of interest in all markets, I guess, but it's particularly of interest where there's a lot of channels. They very quickly got themselves into the US market. You know, most people have cable connections or, you know, they have hundreds of channels. So they could see an advert on any of maybe 10 different channels and knowing which one they actually saw and which one they responded to is extremely valuable to the companies that have paid for these adverts. So it's a way of measuring the response to adverts on TV, which there hasn't really been any other way of doing up till now. People are used to knowing when people respond to adverts online, but they've never really until now been able to tell which adverts work best on TV. And that's what the area that TV Squared covers. After doing the States and obviously the UK, they've now grown into, they've opened an office in Miami for the Latin American market, they've opened an office in Tokyo for the Japanese market and in Sydney for the APAC market. So they really are quite aggressively growing around the world. They've a couple of competitors, but the competitors tend to be US-based and US only. So I think they're definitely making a more ambitious plans to take over the world in this particular territory. And I think they're definitely the leaders in this around the world.
I mean, as Callum explained, you know, in any market which is really fragmented, the more data that you have to be able to work out what works and what doesn't is useful. So yeah, they've got a niche, and it's maybe not such a declining niche that we think, because I mean, as Callum was explaining, that even some of the streaming networks now have advertising, and maybe that could be a growing trend as well. So there could be growth further in that market.
So that one was TV Squared. Third entrant today, something entirely different, and it's technology under the sea and to some extent under the earth. It's WFS Technologies. We met Brendan Hyland, the chief executive, and he explained that their devices, their technology, essentially enables the internet to operate underwater at depth, to provide monitoring of undersea assets, which might be fairly obviously oil installations, energy installations. They might be wind turbines. There are a lot of other applications to do with rising sea levels and climate change and coastal issues for coastal cities, a very fascinating range of possibilities that many of us probably haven't thought of, where the information necessary for real efficiency and prediction of what's going to happen next has to travel through water, across distances, along the length of pipelines, and so on. This is a business which was founded in 2003 simply as Wi-Fi Scotland, but pivoted from just simply trying to spread Wi-Fi across Scotland to these more specialized underwater applications, and is protected, interestingly enough, by 350 patents. So although you can see that this is a kind of thing that the defense industry would get quite excited about, you might think, well, surely the Pentagon would like to control underwater Wi-Fi applications. WFS has clearly protected itself very well. So I thought this was a very fascinating story. Gordon, what did you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the pivot that you mentioned, Brendan, was honest enough to say Wi-Fi for Scotland, they struggle to monetize, so they have to go to the depths of the ocean as an easier place to install and monetize their technology. I think the really exciting part for Brendan and his team, who are clearly smart cookies, is the breadth of uses of this. Everything from extending battery life so that they save companies the equivalent of $100,000 to send out a boat to change a battery, as simple as that, through to aquaculture. How do we get sustainable fishing? How do we protect our shores? How do we defend the shores against climate change? And of course, the developing market into smart cities, population development, and the water sourcing that's going to be critical to the development in the emerging and developed markets. So lots and lots for them to be thinking about and taking advantage of.
And let's hear from Ian.
WFS, yes, I knew Brendan Hyland, who was the founder of this company, in a previous company, and he was telling me about it when he set it up. What they have is they've got RF technology, radio frequency technology, to transmit low levels of data, but through water or through ground. It's very difficult to transmit radio signals through water, but they've got techniques and they've got special frequencies and so forth that allow you to do that. The amount of information you can transmit is quite limited, but that's okay, because in most cases you don't need a lot of information. You know, you probably just need a signal that says we've done the checks and they're all okay. Or we haven't, we've done the checks and there's a problem. So I think it's got real value in the offshore industry. They're now expanding into the renewable industry, where there's a lot of kit buried under the sea. And being able to have an Internet of Things connection to all these bits of kit is invaluable, especially these days when people are moving very much towards the Internet of Things to monitor their estate and what, you know, what equipment they've got based around the place. So I think it's got real value. It's been a bit of a struggle, I have to say, the company. I mean, its turnover now is only $1.5 million, and they've been going for quite a long time, you know, 17, 18 years or whatever. So, you know, it has been difficult to build it. But I think with the acceptance of Internet of Things, I mean, Internet of Things approaches are really just arriving now, and they've had the infrastructure to apply that to underwater subsea applications for a while. So I think their time has come. I think their applications are now very much, and of course they're well proven, so I think they're now really in the right spot to exploit that market as it now grows.
Irene, what was your reaction to this one?
I was really intrigued by this business because, I mean, some similarities with what we do at SeaSense as well, in terms of, you know, we're using sensor technology, we're transmitting data, we're doing this sort of edge processing on the device, but to be able to do this under the sea and also to develop the wireless technology in the first place, which you send it over, is no mean feat. I mean, to be able to have devices that can withstand being underwater, I'm sure must be, I mean, I know from designing bicycle lights, we have to try to keep rain off them, and that's a challenge in itself. To be able to have this gear working underwater plus develop the actual network is amazing. And to think of the wide range of applications for this, it does sound like a really unique opportunity.
And I thought that although it's a business that's been running 15 or 16 years, it clearly is a business of the future, because the ocean is the future in the sense of an enormous source of foodstuffs, of energy, power generation, tidal power, you name it, but also a kind of a threat because of ice caps melting and sea levels rising and so on. So attention to both the potential and the threat of the oceans is something that will become much more important over the coming years. So that was WFS Technologies. And our fourth entrant at lunch today was World 3D. That's in capitals WRLD, 3D. And we welcomed Faizan Ghari. His business is based in Dundee, but he's actually a native of Los Angeles, who's come out of the game software industry into this business, which is doing something unfamiliar to me, which is digital twins, I think was the key phrase. Digital twins means building virtual models of buildings, of cities, indeed of the entire world. Quite hard to get your mind around a digital twin of the entire world. But it's, anyway, a virtual model of the world. It occupies 40 megabytes of data. But I think the more immediate and graspable application of this is the digital twin, the virtual model of a smart building. A building, it might be an office building. Its owners need to maximize space utilization, need to provide a most efficient service for office tenants, short lease tenants and so on, hot desking, all those kind of things. This is a way of doing that. It can then be expanded to smart cities, clusters of buildings, road and infrastructure systems and so on. It can be expanded to retail facilities, shopping malls for maximum utilization, how to drive customer business through the mall with a kind of updated version of Pokemon Go was referred to. So it's 3D mapping and modeling on a very, very sophisticated level. It connects with the whole development of the Internet of Things and the data that comes out of that. Irene, I thought as I listened to it, this is right in C-Sense's territory. What do you think they were adding on to what you and companies like C-Sense already do?
Well, the concept of the digital twin is out there. So, you know, I've been to a few seminars recently talking about, you know, this idea. It is something that I know Ordnance Survey and some other organizations are spending a lot of time thinking about. And it's being able to bring data in and, I guess, as he explained, model that so that decision makers can use that to make decisions. I think what was interesting is how he was saying that they could push his tool down to the user so that people in buildings could be looking at what rooms were available next door to them for room bookings and things like that. So he explained it in a very tangible way that, I guess, you know, the product that they offer is something that you know, users can play with and look at rather than being just a theory or something that highly specialized people with a lot of technical ability are doing in closed offices in the city. So it sounded like he was really pushing towards practical applications of this, which I think is very interesting. And it'll be, I guess, always the challenge will be what data can they get in to feed the models and how do they bring those to life?
Gordon.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Irene, the early part of the presentation, we were talking about digital twins and the claim, the ability to create a digital twin of the entire world. Impressive as that technology is, the immediate question for me was, so what? And therefore, the second half of his presentation to talk about smart buildings, to talk about keeping the millennial employees satisfied, comfortable in the working environment, make sure that everything that we need as consumers, as mall owners, as retailers, is all kind of joined up to be able to use a single platform to make decisions upon which your workforce, your consumers, and the use of your space and your building can be determined is pretty clever.
And a final word from Ian Ritchie.
Yes, World 3D is the difference between them and sort of Google Maps or Apple Maps, because they have 3D mapping, you know, you can fly over a city or whatever, is that World 3D really concentrate on commissions to do indoor experiences. So things like Heathrow Airport, which I see was one of their companies, one of their customers, you know, they built a 3D map of the inside the buildings and so forth, or you can do the fly-throughs, you can do the simulations. Now, this is an area that, you know, people are interested in looking at a 3D map if they're doing a big construction project or whatever, or they, you know, they want to try and envisage something that hasn't been done yet, has not been available yet. But really, the time this will come into its own will be the development of virtual reality and augmented reality. You know that virtual reality headsets have been on the market for a few years now, but they're not widely used because they're uncomfortable to use. The whole feeling is quite artificial. It doesn't quite sort of work. A lot of the industry believe that augmented reality, which is the mixture of virtual reality and projected images, will be a really big success story over the next few years. Microsoft investing in HoloLens, Apple's investing in this territory. There's a company called Magic Leap that's raised $100 million to develop its products. Facebook's got Oculus. So there's a fair number of people spending a lot of money on developing augmented reality. And augmented reality means you walk around, you wear a pair of what looks like glasses, but on top of the image that you can look at, you can project other images. So their solutions should have a good application in that particular territory. I could see as augmented reality starts to become a thing that they will be well placed within that market.
So that's our four entrants for today. A couple of last thoughts on World 3D. One was that Faizan, when I asked him what is the smartest city in the world, he named Shenzhen in China as being the most digitally connected and advanced in all of the ways we were talking about, with Western world cities often still catching up. So a lot to play for in his marketplace. We were also entertained by the thought that Heathrow Airport is adopting his technology to monitor its toilets, even down to the use of toilet paper, which is right on the news agenda today when we read that Brexit could cause a major shortage of toilet paper across the UK. Anyway, on that happy thought, we draw to a close for today's podcast. Four excellent presentations, all having a kind of common theme about the use of data in new ways, the collection of enormous quantities of data and the analysis of it to improve the world in a whole set of different ways. So it's been a fascinating encounter for us. I thank Irene and Gordon and Ian for joining me on this podcast, and I thank you for listening. Thank you.